Church of Mavis. Into the night. Physical. The dark side. Church of Mavis.
Oh, I'm stoked. I'm ready. This is awesome.
Welcome to the Church of Mavis radio show. It's Friday night. Listen to 107.7 FM New Orleans and 105.3 Henderson Point, Mississippi. It's Friday at 7:12 p.m. Central. Had a few books to plug before we get to our guest. These books are all from Thomas Dunn Books, St. Martin's Press. And this one is a really good one. It's Chet Williamson, Robert Bloch's Psycho Sanitarium. It's about it's a continuation of the Psycho books from Robert Bloch, but it's written by a different author, and it takes place during a specific time period in Norman's life. I'm not sure exactly which one, but it's when he goes to the sanitarium. But nonetheless, another one, Kill Switch by Jonathan Mayberry. That's also by St. Martin's Griffin. Jonathan Mayberry writes a lot of zombie books. The Big Sheep by Robert Croes. Sherlock meets Blade Runner in this awesome novel. The Big Sheep explores our fascination with celebrity and futuristic dystopian L.A. with a genetically modified sheep in the center of it all. My goodness. One more. This is by Judith and Garfield Reeves Stevens. Wraith. It's a... Publishers Weekly says it's a fine archaeological quest novel from the Reeves-Stevens duo Icefire. Smoothly blends a fast-moving fantasy plot with a solid scientific backdrop, smart, suspenseful writing, and a clever concept add up to a compelling read. Well, I don't know what these creatures are on the front of this thing, but there's some zombies. There's something going on there. But let me get to our guests. Well, we're going to get to our guests in a minute, but I want to read some of the upcoming guests real quick. We got Wham here tonight. Wham.
Howdy. Yeah.
Codename Wham.
Huh? Wham?
Codename Wham.
Codename Wham.
Next week we got Sam Uzi. He's a writer. I've been finding some people on my Facebook that are kind of unique and bringing them on the show. Like, we don't always have to have, you know, huge guests, or just finding people that are, like, on my friends list. Sam writes a lot of fiction books. Interesting character. That's April 22nd. April 29th, Ed Komarak. He's pretty big in the UFO scene. UFOs, he's got a book on UFOs and Disclosure. He's from Georgia, like me, from Georgia. May 6th is Kirk Morgan. This guy is a trip. He's a musician and claims to have had some UFO encounters and some psychic stuff going on, and his girlfriend's a Mohawk Indian. So So he's, if you look at the site right now, there's a picture of him. He looks like a pretty wild character. So that one should be good. May 13th, from Wham! Will be coming back. Seth Breedlove, that's for the Beast of Whitehall, the Bigfoot show.
Yeah.
May 20th, Mark Zaski, that's the guy in Florida that has some compelling Bigfoot evidence. And May 27th is Andrew Colvin. I better remind him of that soon.
Yeah, do remind him of that.
Yeah, like I have to multiple times. Every day.
Talk about floating off into space.
Yeah. June 3rd, Eileen Pustadano. I can't say her name. Maybe I shouldn't say her last name at all. Eileen from Supernatural Substation. She'll be on June 3rd. Then I got some free dates I'm still trying to fill out. Kevin Turner, Mongolian Shaman, his book Sky Gods, that's June 24th, so I'm looking forward to that for sure. Some Mongolian shamanism. Can't go wrong there.
Nope.
Definitely looking forward to that. All right, tonight's guest is Deborah Diamond. Her book is Life After Near Death, Miraculous Stories of Healing and Transformation in the Extraordinary Lives of People with Newfound Powers by New Page Books. How you doing, Deborah?
Hi, Jeffrey. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Good to have you here. Well, if you could, tell us a little bit about yourself as far as origins, to give some background on yourself for our listeners.
Sure. Well, I'm a psychic medium, but I think my background's probably very different than most people who are psychics. As a matter of fact, if there is such a thing as a typical psychic, I'm pretty sure I'm not it. I have a background in the money management business. I was in the investment business for many years, and that was my professional background, and that's what I trained for. I have an MBA in finance, and I was a professor at Johns Hopkins University, and I was a commentator on CNBC. So my background was very different from what I'm doing today. But when I was in the investment business, I always knew things. And I would, you know, in the investment business back in those days anyway, we always had to do a lot of reading, and they would drop off annual reports and prospectuses and stacks of mail on my desk. And without even reading any of the reports, I would always know about a company's products, about the management, about the industry. And I never really understood how I knew these things. And you know, in the investment business, nobody talks about being psychic. It's just, that's just not part of the business. My boss used to say, you know, Deborah, you have really good instincts. So I thought, I guess I just have good instincts. Maybe I have good intuition. I didn't think too much about it. So it wasn't until 2008 when I decided to take an intuition development class that things started to shift. The class was in New York. It was a weekend class. I live in Baltimore. And I decided to go up to New York for the weekend to take this class because I thought, you know, I have pretty good intuition. It would be fun to learn a few tools to tune it up. So I went up for the class, and on Saturday morning, you know, we were doing a few exercises, and I was getting everything in the exercises. I wasn't sure how that was possible, but I didn't think too much about it. It was pretty low key. And then we took a break, and when we came back, the teacher said, now we're going to have a seance. And that was really not what I came for. I was not interested in the seance. I thought, you know, we're just going to do some nice little exercises with cards and whatnot. But then I figured, well, you know, it was still Saturday morning, and the class went on until Sunday afternoon, and nothing was going to happen anyway. So the teacher explained that she would put us in a meditative state and then take us out of it, and if we saw anything, to let her know. And I thought, well, you know, that's fine. That doesn't pertain to me because I'm not going to see anything. So I meditated, and then she took us out of the meditation, and she said, does anyone see anything? And I looked around the room, and everyone was looking at each other, and I raised my hand, and she said, yes, Deborah, what do you see? And I said, I see about 50 people. So I was seeing people who had passed over who were my family members. I was seeing people who had passed over who were related to people in the class, and then I was just seeing some random people as well. It was overwhelming and frightening, and I wasn't quite sure what to do. The teacher said if I saw someone in the corner of the room, that probably meant they went with someone sitting in that corner. So I said, well, I do see someone in the corner. And I described him. He was Hispanic with dark hair and a handlebar mustache and big white teeth. And as I began to describe him, a woman sitting in that corner began to sob. And she said she could identify him. She said, that was my fiancé. He died 2 years ago. And she asked me if, during the break, if she showed me pictures on her cell phone, would I be able to identify him? And I said, sure, because he was plain as day to me. So during the break, she flipped through some pictures on her cell phone, and I said, there, that's him. You know, I pointed to one of the pictures, and she said, yes, that's my fiancé. He died 2 years ago. Now, she had wanted to hear from him. She believed in all this, and she'd wanted to hear from him and hadn't. So she was very grateful to me for making this connection. And so she gave me a big hug, and she thanked me. Now, it was not lost on me that I had done something meaningful for someone. And, you know, I came out of the investment business where there aren't a lot of thank yous and there's no hugs either. So, you know, this made a pretty big impact on me. The rest of the weekend I was in the class and, you know, a few more things happened. And I was overwhelmed by all of it and didn't really know how to handle it. But Sunday night I drove back to Baltimore and I called one of my sons who scores well on logic tests, and I explained to him what happened. And he didn't say a word, but when I was all done, he said, well, that makes sense. We're just energy, and the energy has to go somewhere. So that gave me a perspective, you know, or context, I guess, to understand what had happened, you know. So that's kind of how the whole thing got kicked off. I didn't tell anybody about what happened because I didn't want to appear crazy. That following summer, I decided to go out to Taos, New Mexico. I don't know if you've ever been to Taos, but Taos is an unusual place. It's highly energetic. There are lots of artists and writers and musicians and spiritual people out there. And, you know, in Taos, when people say, what do you do? And you say, I'm a psychic, they say, me too. You know, it's really not a big deal. So that was really where I began to unpack this energy and this gift that had been given to me, and I began to work with the energy and eventually to do readings and give workshops and whatnot. So that's how I shifted from being in the investment business to working as a psychic and a medium.
Okay, so when you say that you saw them in the room, did you see them? Like you would see anything else pretty much, or was it kind of in your mind's eye? And then the other thing I was wondering, after my dad died in my early 20s, Joel Pritchett was his name, I had a being of light visit me, and basically it was in the cloud tops as a person made out of light, and a friend even saw it with me, and I'm pretty sure it was my dad. And then a few years back, I also had two beings of light. I don't know who they were, but they just, like, left my house. I was watching something, and I went outside and saw two just leaving my house, like they flew out of my roof into the heavens. And I was kind of curious, did you see them like you would see anything else? And also, where does the light fit in? And have you seen them as, like, beings of light also?
No, I saw them as people. they were quite vivid. You know, they looked just like, you know, if you ever have a dream and you see people in a dream, you know, it was like that. I mean, each person that I saw looked just like they did if they were here. You know, I saw them in my mind's eye, but they were all in the room. And they all looked like them because some of them I recognized, some of them I knew, you know, many of them I didn't, but the ones who were associated with me, I knew and I recognized them. So I saw them as people. And, you know, today, I mean, working as a medium, when I read for people and they want me to make contact with their people who have passed over, I see them. You know, I can describe them. I say, you know, this person, you know, it looks a certain way. Their hair is a certain way. You know, they're tall, they're fat, they're short, they're thin. You know, whatever it is, I see them. So I don't see them as light. I see them. in terms of how the light fits in, you know, many people have experiences with balls of light and, you know, seeing the light. You know, the classic is waking up in the middle of the night and, you know, seeing light, and the light could represent someone or not. But, you know, it's probably more common than you think. You know, it's another one of those situations where people don't talk about it. People talk about it with me because I'm a psychic, so, you know, they know I'm not going to laugh at them, you know, but a lot of them that I read for, a lot of people I read for, I speak with, will say, you know, can I tell you something? And I say, sure, and then they tell me, this is what happened to me. I saw this person, I saw light, you know, I had this event where, you know, this extraordinary thing happened to me. So it's not uncommon.
Well, with me, I've never had a near-death experience, but for me, my awakening point was when I was 17. I went through testicular cancer and I had to go through chemo, and I started to have a lot of weird stuff happen to me during that and after it. And then my dad passed away, and I started seeing the beings of light, and I also had a lot of weird UFO stuff with multiple witnesses. But, I mean, I don't know if you consider chemo a near-death experience, but it certainly seemed like at times that I was about to die going through that stuff. That's some ruthless
stuff.
Well,
there's a little bit of a misunderstanding. People think that you have to experience trauma to have a near-death experience, and that's not really the case, but that's been something that's been proliferated by the media. You know, it's true that many people do have NDEs, near-death experiences, as a result of trauma, an accident, a drowning, a heart attack, but not always. But what really defines whether or not it's a near-death experience or spiritually transformative experience is if the person comes back transformed, they've changed, and they can't go back to the way they used to be. That's really what's significant. It's not how many elements you experience. It's not whether you went through a tunnel. It's not whether you had a life review. It's not whether you see a light. It's not any of those things, because some people have very limited experiences, but, you know, come back transformed, and some people, you know, can kind of check off all the elements. The reason that the elements are used to identify near-death experiences is because they were put forth by the scientific community. And the way science looks at things is statistically. So, you know, Raymond Moody identified 8 elements of an NDE, and then Bruce Grayson at the University of Virginia identified another 7 or 8. And that's how science measures an NDE, you know, according to how many elements you've had. But, you know, the truth is that in the near-death experience world, you know, this is not an event that takes place in the linear world. It's not something that, you know, can necessarily be measured by science. And so, you know, I look at it a little bit differently. I mean, I do know that people do experience some of those elements, but not everyone does. And I found actually in the research, a lot of the cases that I spoke with, and the people who were included in this book, there are about a dozen cases in the book, but I spoke with a universe of more than 50 people. A lot of people said to me, you know, I'm not sure my experience was valid because I didn't go through a tunnel, or I'm not sure my experience was valid because I didn't have a life review. And, you know, it's this issue of the media promulgating the idea that, you know, you have to go through a tunnel or see a light. And, you know, the media does it, I'm sure, because these are sensationalistic images, you know, that lend themselves to the wide screen or, you know, to television. You know, they're dramatic. But the bottom line is not everybody, you know, experiences every single one.
Well, I've always called my situation a shamanic death, which I guess that could be very similar or the same thing as an NDE on many levels. But I'm curious, what got you onto this subject? Did you have an experience, or what got you going in this direction?
Yeah, so the reason I decided to pursue this research was because I was asked to do a reading for a famous near-death experiencer. This was a few years back, and this person had a near-death experience and returned from his experience with certain artistic abilities that he didn't have prior to the experience. And so, you know, after I read for him, I started thinking, what happened to him? You know, what about other near-death experiencers? What do they get, if anything? And what are they supposed to do with it? And how do they get it? So I Googled near-death experience after effects, and I found out there hadn't been any research done. So I decided, I guess I'll have to do the research. Now, it's not that far-fetched because, remember, I used to be in the investment business. And in the investment business, for a number of years, I was a healthcare research analyst. So I used to research companies and industries that were so early they weren't even cutting edge. So I knew how to do original research. So, you know, that's how this came about. But I decided to focus just on those people who had cognitive and physiologic after effects. In other words, a lot of people come back from near-death experiences and they are changed and they are psychologically and socially affected. So 65 to 75% of them end up divorced. Many of them come back mediumistic or psychic. Many of them are much more spiritual. But the thing is, I couldn't prove that. If someone came to me and said, you know, I had an experience and I'm more spiritual than I used to be, I can't prove that. I can't look and see how spiritual they were before and measure it against how spiritual they are now. But I could look at, you know, if their eyesight was enhanced or their vision was enhanced or their IQ was enhanced, I mean, that's something that's irrefutable and it's demonstrable. So I decided to focus just on the cognitive and physiologic because, you know, they're irrefutable. So there are people who come back with newfound musical abilities that they didn't have prior to the experience. They have newfound artistic abilities. There are two men in the book. One is a former CEO of a not-for-profit in Mexico, and he was a geologist. He came back as a shamanic artist. There's another individual who's on the faculty of Northwestern University Medical School, and he's an internist, and he came back as an artist. There are people who come back with newfound mathematical ability. There's a woman in the book who gets quantum physics downloads, and she has 32 bins of these downloads in her closet, and she's a former hairdresser, so she's got no background in this. And then there are people who come back with their with a higher IQ. There's a woman in the book whose IQ went from 123 to 145 after the experience, and it had been tested, you know, before and after. So we know that that's true. And I talked to other people whose IQ was enhanced. There are people with enhanced hearing and heightened vision. And these are all documented. There's a guy in the book whose vision went from 2090 to 2010. You know, there are many, many examples of this. And, you know, and there are a lot of cases of spontaneous healing. I mean, people are familiar with this this issue of spontaneous healing because they've heard about Evan Alexander, the Harvard neurosurgeon who had bacterial meningitis and, you know, was healed from that, or Anita Morjani, who was healed of stage 4 cancer. But there are lots and lots and lots and lots of cases of spontaneous healing. Those are just two that people are familiar with, but there are many, many cases of spontaneous healing. There's a fellow in my book, Life After Near Death, who had stage 4 prostate cancer. And he was also addicted to pain pills. He's a physician, actually. He was chief of cardiac anesthesiology at Bakersfield Heart Hospital in California. And he was addicted to pain pills because he had 6 operations for his prostate cancer that weren't successful. And he was also depressed. And he ended up having a 7th operation after they ambulanced him to UCLA Medical Center because he had sepsis. And, you know, besides having stage 4 prostate cancer and everything else. And he had an NDE on the operating table. And within a few days after his surgery and his NDE, he was cured of cancer. He was cured of his pain addiction, pain pill addiction. He was cured of his depression. And he had a, you know, big shift like many of these people do. He sold his 15,000 square foot house that he'd been living in and, you know, it moved into a much smaller house. He quit his medical practice. He sold his Hummer and his Mercedes sports vehicle and bought a Prius. And he's now a healer. So, but, you know, he was completely healed. And there are lots of cases of this. There are lots of cases. So, near-death experiences are, you know, I felt that there was more to them than the elements. There's more to them than the light in the tunnel. And I wanted to examine that and, you know, go a little bit deeper. So, you know, we found that people come back from these experiences with their energy altered. They're not the same, that's for sure. But their energy is also altered, and that seems to play a role in why they have some of these after effects.
Definitely. What do you think, Wham?
Well, I don't know what I was thinking. I mean, I'm kind of amazed. I've almost died three times, and two out from accidents and one from an illness. And I can trace very significant changes that happened in my life after each one of those circumstances. The last thing that happened, the last instance of that was it was maybe not quite 20 years ago, and I was electrocuted accidentally. You know, obviously, I didn't do it on purpose, that I'm aware of. And I was out and was in a grand mal seizure for a number of minutes, and have no real memory of, you know, immediately after. I mean, I can remember the current entering my body, but after that, I don't really have a memory of anything for a while. And I woke up. The person I was living with had found me on the kitchen floor and had picked me up and taken me into the next room, and was in the process of trying to call the ambulance because we lived in a very rural area. And it turned out that it was going to be really difficult to get me to the hospital. And once I came out of it, honestly, they didn't, you know, if you survive something like that, all they really do is medically is they just sort of check your heart and stuff to make sure stuff is working. Because if you survive something like that, that's considered to be kind of like the main thing. And there's not a lot that could be done with electrical injuries. So I basically kind of recovered on my own. And I can tell you that I was completely changed by that experience. My personality changed, and I started pursuing a different path in my own education. I made some significant changes in my life, which led me to where I'm at right now. And it was, I mean, I can't really explain exactly what changed. You know, it was...
Well, for many people, you know, they do go through a substantial shift. I mean, you know, these are normal, everyday people whose lives are turned upside down.
Right. It could
happen to anybody. It could happen to anybody. And for many of them, it's a process that takes a number of years after the experience. For some, it could be the next day. You know, it starts the next day. There's an individual in the book who's a New Age musician. And this person had a NDE in an accident when they were a teenager. And the following day, they went out and bought... They sold everything they owned, and they bought musical equipment, a synthesizer, you know, all sorts of musical equipment. Now, they didn't play music, but they went out and bought all this stuff. And this person has become a rather well-known New Age musician. You know, that started the day after the accident. They say, though, that there's generally a period of about 7 years to adjust to this change. And, you know, for many people, they find that the work that they were doing previously maybe is not satisfying to them anymore. As I mentioned earlier, 65 to 75% of them get divorced because their spouse says to them, you know, honey, if you just stay the way you were, we'd be fine.
Well,
but they can't.
That's one of the things that happened to me, is that my relationship I was in changed really rapidly because I wasn't the same person at all.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, those things happen, and then there are other things that can happen. Sensitivity to light, sensitivity to noise. Some people become vegetarians. They don't want to eat meat anymore. A number of them are electrically sensitive. You don't have to have an NDE to be electrically sensitive, but many of them are electrically sensitive. You know, as I said earlier, many of them become much more spiritual. And, you know, I did readings for all these people, and I gave them questionnaires, and I interviewed them, and I did conventional research. But I also felt that because I'm a psychic and a medium, perhaps if I did readings, I'd be able to uncover something else, you know, about this experience that wasn't readily available, you know, to science. And I asked everyone if they, you know, wanted to have readings, and they all did because they all had questions themselves about what happened, you know. They would say, who are these beings that I met, or how come I didn't go through a tunnel? So they all had questions, but they all had the same two questions, and those were, why me, and what's my mission? Most of these people come back feeling like they're supposed to have a mission now, that they're supposed to help heal the earth, they're supposed to act as batteries of light to heal the earth, they're supposed to do something to help people. So the more fortunate ones are the ones that know what their mission is and can do it. I mean, if you're a musician or an artist or, you know, a healer, those are talents that you can use here on earth, but not everybody gets those abilities. So a lot of them can spend years trying to figure out what their mission is. You know, a lot of people say, how can I have one of these NDEs? They sound so great. And I think, well, maybe I didn't do a very good job of explaining this, because they really do upend your life, and your life is never the same again. You know, people that you were friendly with, you know, you might not be friendly with them anymore because you don't have a lot in common with them. Everything about your life changes.
Oh, I wouldn't wish electrocution on anyone. Seriously, it was. I mean, that the after effects, the physical after effects, were horrible. I mean, it took me many months. It's, you know, it scrambled part of my memory. I mean, I was a graduate student. I had just finished. I was just preparing to do my oral exams. And I had. It took me another 9 months to relearn that information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the way that my memory works is different than it was. My memory, I still have a good memory, but my memory was an eidetic memory before. It was almost photographic, and mm-hmm. it's not that anymore. Although my memory, in some ways, it's not photographic, but in some ways, it's more, I don't know, it's hard to explain really, but it's more, I file things by emotional, intuitive content rather than by kind of linear content, which is mm-hmm. what it was before. So I actually remember certain things better than I did before. I used to be able to just like read a whole book and I could tell you what something was on a page. You know, like I never had to, when I was writing and was doing footnotes or endnotes, I never had to like mark those down. I would know what page they were on and just could, you know, go right to
them. I don't know if that's related to the NDE. There's a woman in the book who came back with enhanced IQ, and her IQ went from 122 to 145, and she had her IQ tested before and afterwards, and she realized after her NDE that her mental processes had sped up. So her you know, she was able to process things much quicker. And she, you know, there were a number of examples of this. She was watching TV with her niece, and they were watching figure skating, and the results were being computed by, you know, calculated by a computer and then put up on the screen. And she was calculating these results faster than, you know, they were calculating them on the computer. And her niece said to her, you know, how are you doing that? So she found that her mental processes had sped up quite a bit. And I've talked to a number of people whose IQs went up. So it's, you know, it's another one of the after effects. So there's, you know, there's many after effects. Not everyone has the same after effects. Not everybody comes back as an artist or, you know, gets quantum physics downloads or has enhanced hearing. But everybody does come back with some after effects. You know, as I said, I just, you know, I focus just on the cognitive and the physiologic. You know, what's been interesting about the book is that I've heard from many people who said, you know, I didn't have an NDE, but something happened to me, and I wasn't quite sure what it was. But after reading the book, all the pieces are starting to come together now, because this is not the kind of thing people talk about. You know, they're starting to talk some about NDEs now because of the success of Eben Alexander's book. But, you know, so that conversation revolves mostly around a personal narrative of, you know, I went through the tunnel and I saw the light. But nobody talks about what happens when you come back. And so this is getting the conversation going not only among NDEers, but for anybody who's had a spiritually transformative experience. And the thing about that is I feel like so many people have had one, they just don't talk about it. I gave a talk in Washington, D.C. a few nights ago to a very buttoned-up crowd, and I started off by asking them how many of them had had an extraordinary experience for which there was no explanation, and half of them raised their hand. And, you know, I was thinking, I bet the other half have had one, too, but they just didn't want to raise their hand because people don't want to, you know, they don't want to admit it. But, you know, these experiences are common, but people don't talk about it. So hopefully this will get the conversation going that, you know, there are after effects from this. And in particular, right now, we seem to be experiencing a shift. You know, more and more people are reporting these experiences. More and more people have an interest in all of this. So things are being sped up. So, you know, hopefully this will provide information to all kinds of people, not just near-death experiencers.
So have you been in contact with, I'm assuming you're not working in the financial field anymore.
No.
Well, the reason I ask is that I was just going to ask if you're in contact with any of those people.
People in the investment business?
Yeah, that you used to hang out with.
Well, I know, you know, there's still a few people that I'm friendly with, but, you know, in terms of, you know, going to the office and sitting on the trading desk, and, you know, that sort of thing, no, I don't do any of that anymore.
Right.
People
right.
who've known me for a very long time, you know, when you're friends with someone for, you know, years and years and years, everybody goes through all kinds of things, not necessarily something like this, but, you know, people go through things. So my family, you know, friends who've been friends for a long time, they all kind of go with the flow. But, you know, in the context of the investment business overall, I'm quite sure that most of those people would have any idea what I'm talking about.
How do you think... How do you think worlds like that would change if more individuals in that realm would have these experiences and admit to them?
Well,
I'm just curious, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is pure speculation. It's nothing that I studied in the book. But you know, one thing about near-death experiencers is that they don't have any money. Because they don't care about money. You know, they're not
right.
driven by that. So whereas the investment business, Wall Street and whatnot, you know, that's all about money. So,
right.
you know, undoubtedly it would profoundly affect people. But, you know, there's certain people who are candidates for this experience. And there seems to be a certain type of person that has these experiences. And we found that for the people who are in this book, the cases in the book, many of them came from abusive families. Many of them came from abusive backgrounds. So I found this out when I was reading for them, because I would be doing readings and I would see, you know, I would see this show up when they were children, and then I would ask them about it, and they say, yes, you know, I did, that did happen. And then it developed a pattern. You know, I started seeing it in many of the readings. So many of them come from a pattern of abuse. Many of them were out of step. You know, they always, you know, the classic is they say, I always felt different. So many of them were always out of step. And many of them, for many of them, their lives were referenced by darkness. So it seems as if they were candidates for this kind of experience. I mean, this is not the kind of experience that you can choose for yourself. You know, some people think they can bring on an NDE. You can't. You cannot, you know, William James, the Harvard philosopher, said in 1904, you cannot bring on a noetic experience like this. And anybody who tells you that they can is lying. You cannot bring it on yourself. But it appears as if there are certain people who are candidates for this, and it's almost as if the universe is kind of eyeing people and saying, you know, here's someone who's a candidate. Their lives are referenced by darkness, and they can be turned towards the light and be used for a higher purpose. And that seems to be what's going on with most of these people. They go through this shift, and, you know, and then, of course, they feel like they have a mission and they want to do good. So, you know, there's a lot involved, and it's there's certain themes that run through all of this that keep reappearing. And one of those themes, of course, is the type of person that, you know, has these experiences.
Jeffrey, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I have a chat room ability to these people.
All right.
I'm here. I was listening, but I also have to communicate with the audience. It's pretty packed up here tonight on Pal Talk. So.
Do they have any questions?
They're listening and complimenting highly, but no questions yet. If anybody's got any questions, just let us know. Just type it in the chat room. One thing, what time is it? Okay. Oh, Deborah, what? How was your transition from Wall Street money manager to this, and how do people react to that?
Well, it was, you know, it took place over a number of years. So, you know, it's not like one day I was on Wall Street and the next day I was doing this. I mean, it really took some time because I ended up moving to Taos, New Mexico, as I said, and I lived out there for a number of years. And while I lived out there, I began to, you know, work with this energy, and I began to do psychic readings and, you know, feel comfortable around this whole, you know, with this aspect. So that went on for a number of years before I even came back to the East Coast. And then when I came back to the East Coast, I thought originally I wasn't going to be doing this work at all, because the East Coast is not like Taos, New Mexico. You know, it's pretty conservative and traditional. And I just didn't think I was going to be doing this, but I think somebody else must have had another idea, you know, in mind for me. And I ended up, people started coming to me for readings, and you know, I ended up having a practice here. So it's been something that's been, you know, gradual over a number of years. But I have to say, I read for a lot of people who are like me. I read for a lot of professionals. I read for people from the State Department. I read for people from NASA, from USAID, from NIH, you know, people who are educated professionals. And, you know, this shift and this phenomenon affects everybody. I mean, I don't read for, I'm trying to think if I read for anybody from Wall Street, but I read for lots of people who are, you know, professionals you know, people are much more open to all of this today. You know, you see TV shows about it, movies about it, books about it. You know, we're going through an unusual period. So, and I'm very comfortable, you know, doing what I do. I have family, you know, children who are all professionals, and they all, you know, they're all good with it. I don't think they think anything of it, quite honestly.
And I'm kind of curious, everybody that, you know, has the NDEs that you've talked to, how do they describe the afterlife? Do they ever really get into it in detail?
Well, you know, the one thing about these noetic experiences is that they're ineffable. You can't describe them. We don't have the vocabulary to describe this realm. It's a realm, it's not at all like our Earth. You know, I think here on Earth, everyone thinks that if there is an afterlife or they're aliens, you know, they look kind of like us, but you know, with pointier heads or an extra eye or something. And I think that these other realms are places that we can't imagine. We don't have the vocabulary because they're not at all like our Earth or anything that we know. You know, they seem to be energetic realms. I ended up going, you know, with people on their NDEs, and I found myself in much the same position that they were in. You know, I couldn't describe it either. So, you know, they're just not, our points of reference, I think, are somewhat limited. You know, we live in a 3D world, and that's our frame of reference. But these other realms are infinite, and you know, they can't be compared to anything that we know.
So there's many realms, so to speak. I've had an experience where I've woke up after like 3 a.m. or 4 a.m., and then I've gone and looked at the sky, and I've seen those beams of light everywhere, like around the planet on some level. Almost like they're, like you see stars normally, but there's like these little pinpoints, it's like collectives of them. So I've kind of come to the conclusion that there's like a quantum realm around the Earth, and maybe, you know, when you die, it's like the staging area that you get kind of sucked into, and it's like a little staging area, and I guess maybe they usher you off wherever else. But I've definitely seen the beams of light, and then I came across a quote in a Jeffrey Mishlove book called Roots of Consciousness. I need to find that book again because I can't remember the astronomer's name. It was some old-timey astronomer, but he said some stars are indeed deities. So I've seen those beings of light in the sky, and they're not stars. They're like people.
You know, it's an interesting observation because many of the people in the book and many of the people I spoke to made similar comments to me about they would get called outside in the middle of the night to look at the stars. Or when they close their eyes, they see stars. And they felt that in their experiences, wherever they were taken, they, you know, would see these pinpoints of light or see stars. So there was a constant theme that, you know, ran throughout this experience that echoes among all the experiencers and seems to continue after they return here. You know, another theme that surfaced was this whole idea of manifestation and intention. Many of these people asked for the experience, outright asked for it. The one woman in the book, the one who gets the quantum physics downloads, was standing outside the Baha'i Temple in Wilmette, Illinois, on a Saturday afternoon watching folks get married, and she was at that time having some problems with her boyfriend. So she stood outside that temple and she said, "God, if there's something else out there, I'm not taking one more step forward until you show it to me." An hour later, she was in the hospital with a cardiac arrest, and the physician, and she was 32 years old, and the physician said to her parents, you know, "Why didn't anyone know about her medical history with her heart?" And her parents said, "Well, because there's not a problem with her heart." So she asked for this, and when she read the book, she sent me an email, and she said, "I forgot to tell you something." I said, "What's that?" She said, "I asked for it again, and I had the same experience." So, now, she's not the first person I've talked to who said, you know, she's asked for it and it happened. You know, now I said earlier you can't create an NDE, and I mean that. It has to be, it has to happen jointly with the universe. But there seem to be many people who, if they don't outright ask for it, at least they're kind of in training for it. So what do I mean by that? That means that perhaps they're becoming more spiritual, maybe they're changing their diet, you know, maybe they're becoming vegetarians, maybe they're starting to practice yoga. You know, all these things sort of sort of greasing the wheels before the event. It's, you know, in intention and manifestation definitely play a role in this. And everyone also, you know, one of the questions they had in their readings was, why did the reality, the NDE, seem so much more real than our reality? Boy, they all asked that, you know. And the answer to that seemed to be the fact that, you know, when our consciousness is attached to our physical body, it's, you know, it's weighted down by that heavy physicality. And it's because of it, you know, our consciousness is not entirely free and clear to experience, you know, the total universe and the total all and oneness. But when it's clear of our physical body, that's the true reality, and that's when everything seems so expansive and clear to these folks. So, it's interesting that they all seem to think that this doesn't feel real down here, but that felt real out there.
Well, hey, we got to go on break real quick. Our producer is summoning me. We're going to go on break for about 8 minutes. How long do you have, Deborah? We have an eight-minute break now, and then there's the rest of the show for like another 45 to 50 minutes. Can you do that, or do you need less time? Or
I am not able to do it. I thought we were done around 9. Well, I guess it would be 8 o'clock your time, right? Or
Okay,
I think I'm an hour ahead of you.
You're ready to close out? That's fine. Okay, what is your website?
So I have two websites. One is DeborahDiamondPsychic.com. That's D-E-B-R-A, Diamond, D-I-A-M-O-N-D, like a diamond ring. DeborahDiamondPsychic.com, and then DeborahDiamondAuthor.com. And you can contact me for a reading. I don't read just for NDEers. You can contact me for a reading if you're interested through the website. There's also a Facebook page, Life After Near Death, which you're welcome to like. And, and the book, Life After Near Death, is available on my website, Deborah Diamond Author, also on online at Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com, and in retailers.
All right. Well, we appreciate it. We've enjoyed you as a guest, and keep us in the loop on future books. It's from New Page Books. They always have great books. Thanks, and have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
All righty. All right, everybody, we're going on break. We'll be back in 8 minutes.
There is a house in New Orleans. They call God, I know I'm one.
Welcome back to America.
Thank you.
The Church of Mabel.
Oh, I'm stoked. I'm ready.
Welcome back to the Church of Mavis Radio Show. We're back. We're live.
Back and live.
I wasn't sure how long the guest was going to do. I thought the whole thing, but some of them do an hour, some of them do two. It's out of my control, so you adjust accordingly. Tartu is sad. He has a sad face. Great guest. Too bad she couldn't stay for the full show. Well, you got us now, Tartu.
Yep.
That's right.
Here we are.
Just you and us and your underwear on webcam tonight. But let me see. What was I going to talk about? Oh, what did you want to talk about first?
Well, no, I was just saying, if you want to... it's also a guest I could suggest for a later time, but are you familiar at all with Gregory Little?
That name sounds really familiar.
Well, he's done some work with Andrew Collins, but he has written several books, the most recent one of which is actually quite interesting. He's a guy, he's a Southerner. He lives in Tennessee, I believe. And he has a PhD in counseling. He's a psychologist by profession. I believe that he works in criminology and addiction counseling, that kind of thing. But in his spare time, he has been, over the last 20 years or so, he has been meticulously visiting and interviewing and cataloging all of the mounds and petroglyphs and various native earthworks in North America, and he wrote a book. It's been about 18 months ago that he published it, called "The Path of Souls: The Native American Death Journey, Cygnus, Orion, the Milky Way, Giant Skeletons and Mounds, and the Smithsonian," which is a whole bunch of stuff. But what is cool about the book, first of all, he does talk about the whole business of the giant skeletons and the mounds, you know, and that conspiracy and everything. And so that's a part of the book, because obviously that idea, that rumor, is associated with some of the mounds, you know. But most of what the book is, probably about three-quarters of what the book is just a brief sort of narrative introduction to the history, what has finally been put together, of the history of all of the different mound structures in North America, of which, you know, east of the Mississippi, it is now estimated conservatively that prior to contact, there were probably over a million structures.
Wow.
And these structures, there are four distinct stages of the structures, or I guess you would say historical periods to them, even though they all sort of overlap too, which is what makes them kind of confusing, or has made them confusing. And through very careful work, archaeologists and some work that he has done and some work that Andrew Collins has done, they've begun to put together what at least some of these structures were probably for. You know, how they, you know, the ritual and sort of mythological ideas behind them, and it's really interesting. I knew nothing about it at all, and I don't know that a lot of Americans do.
Probably not.
You know, but it's really fascinating. So you know, if you want me to talk about it a little bit, I will.
that'd be cool for sure. I have to check out the book. I've interviewed Dan Collins before.
Yeah, I mean, and it's like, well, you know, I'll try to be real brief. And then Andrew Collins. What?
Don't have to be too brief.
Yeah, well, then Andrew Collins kind of does this, he does this afterward, because, you know, he is introduced sort of an alternative way of looking at what the three pyramids of Giza represent. You know, for a long time we thought that they represented the belt of Orion, but he introduced the idea that perhaps they actually represented the three stars of that are associated with Cygnus, which is a like a bird eagle constellation. And the reason that's important is that Cygnus turns out to be an important constellation for at least many of the larger mound cultures in North America as well. So that's what that connection is. But anyway, and down where you live, there are probably some mounds. And if you remember, Peter Lavenda talks about mounds. So just to be really, really brief about the history, what they have uncovered is that there are four main ages of mounds. The first age of mounds are called the Archaic Period, and a lot of these mounds are what they call midden mounds. They're mounds that were created by people like eating lots of seafood and then piling up the seashells and stuff in different patterns. And some of these are really old. The oldest of the settlements that are associated with these mounds are in Louisiana. And there's a place called Poverty Point, which I'm sure that Joe has heard of. And people were living there and built a fairly large city complex there, that is as old as Stonehenge. So those are the first group that. These archaic people, or we don't really know exactly what influenced them to build mounds, but they just did. And then there's another group of mound builders that emerged in the Ohio area, around in there, the Ohio Valley area, and they're called the Adena Mounds. They actually popped up in several places, but that's the center of them. And these are associated with kind of cone-shaped burial mounds, and the mounds were mostly used for burials, essentially. And then there was another group that came after that are called the Hopewell Mounds. And what's interesting about these different groups of mound builders is that it's what they seem to be associated with the development of certain kinds of technology, and also with a certain kind of style, so that it wasn't like necessarily just like one people that built these mounds, but like one group of people would start to build mounds, and then other peoples would apparently go, oh, they're building mounds, and then they would go home and they'd build their own mounds, that kind of thing. So they're like slightly different styles of the same thing. So the Hopewell culture, as it's called, also seemed to sort of come out of the Adena culture in one way or another, but there were people that continued to build Adena-style mounds anyway. But the Hopewell culture, those mounds are associated with the more complicated earthworks, like that serpent mound that is in Ohio, and fortifications, what are called hill forts. And they're not quite as widespread as what happened later on, but this appears to be, again, more of a style of building than it does any one culture, but it does appear to be associated with the infusion of certain types of technology, like the use of the atoll, or whatever it's called, the spear thrower. So the people who are associated with the Hopewell culture tend to be using that. And the Hopewell culture is also a lot of the, not all, but some of at least of the mounds appear to be defensive in orientation. And those were built, they started to be built maybe, 800 to 500 BC to about maybe 500 AD or so. That was the main period. And then the third larger period was clearly connected to some kind of infusion of culture from Central America or Mexico. They don't know which. And this is connected to what's called the Mississippian culture. And these were much larger city complexes. There were still some people that still built, like in the Hopewell style or whatever. But then what you found is that they would build these large platform pyramidal, flattened, you know, they'd have a pyramidal shape, but they'd be flat on top. They're called platform mounds, because on top of the platform mounds, there would be like huts or houses, you know, where like high priests would live. And this is called the Mississippian culture. And the reason it's called that is because a lot of these mounds and these cultural complexes occurred specifically on river valleys, Mississippi being the most important, but basically all through the southeastern United States. Gregory Little did was that he created something that's called the Encyclopedia of Mounds and Earthworks in North America, which I did get, and it's only like $35 for a big old hardcover book. And it basically, it goes state by state and is a catalog of virtually every single earthwork or mound complex that still exists that we know of. But the truth is that they're being found every year. Even now, they're being found every year, new ones. Because some of them were like little small areas that people would just abandon, or they're on private property where people just think they're a hill, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
and then people find out, oh my God, you know, it's a mound. It's got stuff in it. So it's really kind of like this native history is like all around us in a lot of ways. And a lot of people are completely unaware of it. I mean, there's not a single state basically east of the Mississippi that doesn't have some vestige of this somewhere.
Nice. Yeah, one of my neighbors showed me an arrowhead he found, and he had it in a little glass frame, but he found it here on my land before I moved and built the house here. It was kind of cool.
Oh, right. Yeah, well, Georgia and Florida have a lot of them. In fact, Georgia is one of the states that had, at one point at least, a lot of structures. And it was a center. See, and there were things that I learned that I did, you know, from all of this that I didn't realize. Like, for example, just the Cherokee people. We think of the Cherokee people as the Cherokee people, right? Well,
yeah.
There were several different kinds of Cherokee people. There were several different, not even bands, but branches of them. And they were all related and spoke similar language and stuff. But some of them had very, very different. They didn't all do exactly the same ritual stuff, and especially the Cherokee that were in Georgia, that were a little more southern, some of them were mound builders and did participate in this Mississippian culture. The Mississippian culture was known for, they were apparently, whatever this influence was, they brought in heavy-duty agricultural stuff, you know, corn, maize, the Three Sisters. They also tended to, there was a religious ritual that was associated with the culture that tended apparently to promote a certain kind of religious elite that would act as priests over everybody else. And apparently that didn't, you know, after a while there were some natives, you know, that there were some groups that didn't like that very much. And so by the early 16th century, when Hernando de Soto first accidentally started running into these folks down in the southern part of what is now the U.S., there were some places where there had already been some popular revolts, apparently, against some of these priestly elites. So there were places where this culture was in decline, or this religious cult, I guess you would say, was in decline. But it's really completely interesting. The religious cult was focused around the there were two constellations that it focused around, and one was the what we call the three belts of Orion. They apparently saw as a severed wrist, you know, a hand that had been severed at the wrist. So where those three stars are, that was the wrist. And then they saw a hand there, and where those two stars sort of hang down from the belt, that was called the eye. And at certain times of the year, they would do rituals for the dead. Everybody that had died in between certain periods, they would do this long ritual where the souls of the dead were set free to sort of fling themselves, I guess, at this eye, and that was held by this hand. And if they made it through, the eye, they could then travel to Cygnus, where they would be taken. They would be challenged by like a trickster figure, and then they would be, if they succeeded because they were good moral people or something, you know, whatever the conditions were, they would be taken up into the stars, and they would travel on the path of the Milky Way to heaven or to the ancestors. And if not, then they were captured by the great spider goddess in the sky, who would capture their souls to keep them from falling into oblivion, and bring them back to Earth to reincarnate.
Wow.
So it was this whole elaborate ritual, and these temple, these mounds were all about that. They were built to, you know, cite not only the solstices and the equinoxes.
We'll go to great lengths to get you hot
pizza. With,
introducing the 2016 Domino's DXP.
Stars that are connected to, you know, this myth, and they were also built to trace the very, very complicated path of the moon, which is actually kind of interesting because there are very few cultures in the world that actually take the trouble to track the complicated path of the moon, because it takes 18 years or something to completely track it.
Yeah.
So it's a great book. I mean, I'd highly recommend it.
So I'm going to have to check it out for sure. Cop in the chat room was saying three sisters are corn, squash, and beans, three federally recognized Cherokee tribes, Cherokee Nation, United Kiowa Band of Cherokee Indians, have headquarters in Tahlequah, Oklahoma.
Right. Right.
I've seen pictures of my great-grandmother. She's Cherokee, and she was dressed up like how they dress. I don't know how old the picture was. It was black and white. So I definitely know I have Cherokee in my family. And I've had weird Native American, obscene Native American spirits. One time during my party days, I saw a bunch of them standing around in the room with me.
Just most people would never consider that they could put
with my eyes, and it freaked me out, and I went outside. But my dad said he saw a Native American ghost of a chief, and he never drank or did drugs or anything, and he would talk about it, and I always thought he was just nuts. But after I saw him, I was like, maybe there's something to that story.
Well, I do kind of think that, you know, it's weird. I do kind of think that they, on some level, I mean, I know the Algonquin people here have this belief that there were people that they call land keepers, and these were individuals who, before they died, they would take a vow to never leave the earth until the earth had gone through its final purification. And so they sort of act as guardians of the earth, and so they're always here. And so occasionally people can see them, you know, if they're, I guess, so gifted or you know, the situation is right.
Definitely. I saw a Nova PBS special documentary that just came out about, and I also put up an article about it, but about these the Vikings, and they're using some new satellite technology, and they're finding Viking longhouses and settlements in there on North America. I think they have a long time ago, but they just found a new one, and basically are here before Columbus, and you know, we're telling stories about how they probably intermingled with the native tribes and fought, and just thinking about Native Americans battling Vikings. I'm sure it's not a situation you want to be in, but it still sounds pretty cool when you think about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you're talking about the longhouse they found in what, Newfoundland or something, the new one.
Yeah,
it would be hard though, because you know, I mean, one of the things that the colonists found when they came here was that you know it was actually, I mean, while there are some things that are the same between Europe and the North America, there are some things that are really different too, and like some of the things that you can eat or not eat are really different. And so it would have been hard, I think, for Vikings to come here and to survive meaningfully, because there would be certain things that they would be without. You know, Vikings were accustomed to having a milk culture there. You know, having their livestock there, and that wouldn't have been present. And they would have been accustomed to having certain types of fish to eat. And while there were things that they could eat, they may or may not have known what those things were, you know. So it would have been tough. It would have been tough. Of course, they were tough, but
and how would they automatically just attack the natives? I don't see them like being nice and trading. I mean, maybe.
I don't know. It's like, it would really depend on how they were. I mean, I know that in Iceland, what they called the natives, they used the term skraling, which means wretches. So they didn't like the natives very much. But I think the natives probably, you know, I mean, I think it was probably mutual that they didn't like each other very much. And the natives would have had an advantage in that situation.
I'm going to have to check out that book for sure.
Yeah, and it also, like I said, it also has stuff, interesting stuff about those skeletons, those so-called giant skeletons, which you might find interesting.
Definitely, I love that stuff. I know I was watching Ancient Aliens that had a UFO Bigfoot show, and I was surprised how much they were linking giants to Bigfoot and pretty much saying they're probably the same thing, which I think there's definitely some kind of connection there with that too as well, when it comes to Bigfoot and, you know, the giant stories and all that. I definitely see a connection. Who's the guy? The old great Smithsonian cover-up. We've had him on the show, but Richard Dewhurst, yeah, about the Smithsonian cover-up. I want to get one of those DNA tests and see what my stuff comes back as. I know there's Cherokee, but for some reason I've heard French and Irish, but I really just don't know. I'm trying to figure out the best one to do. Do you know which one's probably the best one to do? Have you ever did any of those things?
You mean of the DNA? I did a DNA test a long time ago, like when the DNA... when the DNA stuff first came out, I had to do one because, well, this was when I was first moving to Annapolis and I was going to be working at a military installation, so, you know, at the Naval Academy, so we had to have all that stuff done. And so they did it, you know, they did it. They just wanted to make sure that, you know, I wasn't affiliated with any criminals that they had on record, which I wasn't. So I don't know what company they used.
What did yours come back as?
Well, you know, I didn't ask them for a racial breakdown. I guess I could go back and look. They were just trying to make sure that I was not in a criminal database. So I really don't know exactly how it would come back. I think that I would imagine.
I need to figure out the best one. I know there's several different ones, but
yeah, there's several different ones, and I haven't actually done
23
the
and something other. And
yeah, I haven't done the whole profile. I wouldn't be surprised if what I know about my family background, though. I mean, I know quite a bit about, you know, the hereditary background. I wouldn't be surprised if there isn't some Neanderthal in there somewhere. So,
got our Native American friend Coppin here, who I believe is still a Trump supporter. I still don't understand that. That's like a Native American voting for Trump's like a Native
Whatever.
American voting for Custard. But nonetheless, he said, I'm always giving him hell about that. But also tell her they found a Jewish artifact in a cave that belongs to the Cherokee in North Carolina dating back centuries ago. Could it be the Lost Tribe? Something about a Jewish artifact in a
yeah,
cave.
Yeah, well, there are actually a number of different claims like that. I don't know anything about that particular artifact. You know, there
he
are,
said he's going to scalpel me.
He's got a what?
He said he's going to scalp me for saying that. What I said earlier about Trump being Custard. Yeah, I don't have any hair, so you're just going to get forehead, buddy. But, how about that Bernie tore up Hillary last night? Oh my goodness!
Well, I did not watch it, so I don't have any
idea. It was great. I swear she reminds me of like one of those reptilian Illuminati shapeshifting lizards. Like there's just something. I don't mind a woman president. I let Elizabeth Warren all day long, and there's some Hawaiian chick that's pro Bernie that quit the Democratic Party, and she would. I like someone like those two, but there's something about Hillary just, she's like a freaking cobra. I just don't like her.
Well, you know, she is a Scorpio, I think, so, you know.
Yeah, there's something about her. It gives me the willies.
She's
Bernie
tough.
Tore her up last night. I mean, it was, I was laughing hardcore on that one. He was just going for the throat, for sure.
What were they talking about? I mean, because I, like I said, I didn't see it.
Well, basically, she's just so sold out and takes money from all the people that she's supposed to be reforming and protecting us from, and she won't release her transcripts with all the Wall Street people and all these people, and she says she doesn't have to, and because no one else is having to do it or something. Basically, they're saying if she was to release those transcripts, that she would probably lose the presidency. She would probably, it'd probably be over for her, but she won't release them. And he was just going after her on it. And then he went into Israel and the Palestinians and kind of took, you know, he's Jewish, so I mean, he took the Israel side on some level, but he said that they overreact with the Palestinians on some level too, so he was kind of protective of them. So just all kinds of different subjects, but mostly, I mean, he gets her on voting for the war in Iraq. Like, oh, man, he just slams her on that every time. Like, you voted for the war on Iraq. That's one of the big ones. He just, he's the only politician I've ever really seen. And Trump does it some, too, but Trump's methods are just stupid. Like, Trump's so alienated so many other races that he must be a complete moron, because you're going to need all those other races to win. You can't upset entire races and expect to win the presidency by, you know, upsetting Muslims and Mexicans and blah, 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 and gays or whatever. You're not going to win without those votes. And it's like, did you miss that train in your brain or what, dude? Yeah. But Bernie's just continually, I've never seen a politician go after the corruption on such a level of intellect and razor-sharp wit that he does. And that's why people love him, because he's standing up for, you know, he released his tax returns, and Hillary makes what he makes speaking at one event for Goldman Sachs, what he makes in a year. She makes more than him just speaking for 2 hours somewhere. So it was definitely amusing to watch.
Yeah, she is a corporate... A corporate dude, that is true.
And then there was that whole thing where some Sanders supporter called the Democratic corporate whores, And everybody got upset, and Bernie apologized, and he didn't even say it. It's just ridiculous. I've always been done with the right because I just find the leadership to be complete hypocritical morons. They shovel Jesus down your throat while pissing on you at the same time. But the left, I'm done with them too. They're completely sold out. That's one thing I've learned with Bernie. I haven't been in politics that very long anyway. It's never been my bag. But I voted for Kerry. I voted for Obama twice, and then here I am. And this one, I'm voting for Bernie in November. If it's Trump and Hillary, I won't vote for either of them. I'll write Bernie on the thing, and then I'm done. Because he's completely exposed them for what they are. They're all corrupt, taking money from the people that are ripping us off. There's a good movie called, God, what was it, The Shortcut? I always mess up the title. The Shortcut. He's a democratic socialist. There's a difference between that and a socialist. The socialist is like Russia, Stalin, blah, 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 North Korea, and all that crap. Democratic socialist is Canada, Sweden, Iceland. There's a difference. But anyway, when it comes to, I just like him because he exposes the corruption. There's no such thing as a democratic socialist. He is a democratic socialist. There's democratic. So what would you rather have, capitalism? People telling you about Jesus while they pee on you and rob you blind? Not me. But nonetheless, chat room discussion. Fascism, that's the right-wing extremist in the right-wing party. Trump is a resurrection of Adolf Hitler. George W. Bush, if that wasn't an antichrist, I don't know what was. But Trump is a carbon copy of that, for sure. What about Ted Cruz?
are you talking to the chat people?
I'm talking to Eileen. She's trying to push my buttons. I'm going to have to bite her feet off.
You're going to bite her feet off.
I'm just kidding. But, no, I had to lay down because my back's hurting. Like, I'm in a computer desk all the time, so I was like, oh, I'm sitting up now, but my back is doing crazy stuff there for a while. But, as far as if Bernie doesn't get the nomination, which of course is rigged, so he's probably not going to get it anyway, and the same thing what they're doing with Trump, why don't we talk about aliens no more? We can talk about aliens. But nonetheless, Trump, as far as what they're about to do to him, well, I don't think they're going to do it, but they're trying to set up some crazy stuff at the convention to not give him the nomination and put someone else in, like a straw man. If they do that, they're going to have bombs going off from all the Aryan right-wing extremists. But nonetheless, yeah, politics, after the Bernie's not the nomination, I'm done with it. They can burn in hell, both sides. I don't really care. I'm sick of it. It's sad that our country is, you know, it's just a joke now. It really, America's become a joke. It's a punchline.
I do think that it's too bad that neither party, I mean, for the most part, you know, I mean, Bernie is at least exciting people's passions a little bit. You know, I guess Trump is doing that too, but not really passions that I think are necessarily our most attractive feature. But when it comes to the Republican Party, it's like, wow, guys, this is the best you can do? You know, I mean, like, really? Like, really? It's really disturbing. I mean,
definitely.
I have friends who live overseas, you know, who are international people who live overseas, and they think we're insane.
It's
completely freaking nuts.
I'm embarrassed.
You know, and it's like I have to tell them. It's like, you know what? I agree with you. I have no idea. I mean, I suppose I could give a political or social analysis of how we have come to this. But it's like, it just makes me so ill that I just don't even want to think about it very much.
It definitely does. My sister was saying, her friends in Canada are saying that if everybody's too stupid to not vote for, basically if you're not voting for Bernie here, you're an idiot. and you get what you deserve, which will be Trump, probably. That's what the Canadians I know have said about us.
Yeah, that's
November, I think they're setting it up. It's completely set up for Queen Hillary and the Iron Throne. If Bernie wins, which I would love for him to, but I just don't. But I believe Obama probably wants Hillary in, of course, to continue his legacy. When you got the White House and Obama and the government behind you, you're going to win. You got the Iron Throne. So that's who I think is going to get it. And plus, so many blacks and Latinos love her for some reason. They don't care that she's completely sold out. They just think, oh, Bill Clinton, he's cool. He plays a saxophone, whatever, whatever. He got, you know, population in the White House. He's groovy. We're going to vote for her.
Yeah, I
don't
know.
You got women that are just going to vote for her because she's just a woman. So
yeah.
I think she's going to win by a landslide, and she'll probably destroy Trump or whoever. Trump, I'm sure it'll be her versus Trump.
Yeah, that's real. I mean, it's weird. It's like, you know, I mean, it's like she and Trump represent like the two butt ends. Of the worst aspects of our political system.
I have to deal with Trump supporters where I work at before Fox News in the comments, and I'll put up some positive Trump stuff just to get their clicks or whatever, but then I started putting up, you know, negative Trump stuff. I put up negative Clinton stuff too, but they go crazy. They've attacked me. They've stalked me. They're not going to click my articles anymore. I'm like, what? I'm just sharing positive and negative about Trump. But, I mean, dropping the N-word, Jews this, Jews that, they're not going to visit my articles anymore because I posted a negative Trump thing. They're crazy. And that's just it. Trump is a liberal. He's channeled, you know, millions into Hillary. There's pictures of him smoozing her at parties and, like, basically hugging her, hanging out with her little tuxedos and stuff. I think Trump is a complete act, and that, you know, so many, you know, right-wingers are buying it tooth and nail. It's just, I just can't believe they're so stupid.
Oh, I know. I've had this vision. I've had this vision that, you know, that Trump wins. You know, we wake up the next morning after the election, and we wake up to Trump being in the White House, and then Trump announces that he doesn't want this job. And so he's going to hand it over to, like, you know, his people that he's delegating it to. You know, he's going to try to just, like, walk away from it or something, you know, completely throw everything into shambles and just refuse to do anything presidential, because after all, he's a CEO, he doesn't have to, right? And that it's sort of like, well, what the hell do you do with that, you know?
He's already pretty much destroyed the Republican Party. That's the good thing about him. What was Kasich saying about if a woman goes to a party with alcohol, she gets what she deserves when it comes to assault?
Oh, I don't know the exact quote, but I think the implication was that don't go to parties with alcohol, because if you do, then, well, if something happens, then, you know, well, you didn't have to go to the party with alcohol.
A nutbag thing to say. That's like one of those, one of the Republicans said women are cuts of lesser beef or something. They always say weird anti-women stuff.
Cuts of lesser beef.
Yeah, there was one right-wing extremist that said something to the effect of women are lesser cuts of meat. That's why I don't understand why women vote Republican. It's like, why don't you just beat yourself in the face?
Well, then you could ask him, well, why are you married to a lesser cut of beef?
Yeah. Crazy. Like,
yeah.
John Leguizamo said about Latinos voting for Republican is like roaches voting for Raid. That's John Leguizamo, the actor.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's you know, I have family that comes from Kansas, and people in Kansas they vote against their own interests all the time, and have for a long time. It's sort of like, you know, somehow Governor Brownback got in twice as governor, and he's completely destroyed the state. And
yeah, I don't understand why people vote against their own interests. It's like, it's all, I guess, because they think it's going to trickle down and they're all going to become Donald Trump and have a Russian mail order bride.
Yeah.
tried that Russian Miller Bride thing, sort of, on my side. It was terrible.
Oh, she wasn't quite a mail order bride, though, was she?
Oh, but she's more like a massage therapist slash prostitute. She wasn't a full-blown prostitute, but let's just say there might have been some risky stuff going on some level.
On
that
the
I
side,
didn't need to be
mean?
A part of. But nonetheless, that's enough.
That's enough of that. That's enough of that. Don't want to go there.
But I've been broke up with the Russians since, was it January?
Yeah,
it's January.
Right after Christmas.
I've just given up. Completely. But nonetheless, no more Russians, that's for sure. I'm done with those. But it was nice to try out. Well, nice to oh yeah, what was up with that Facebook picture of some woman and her big boobs you shared?
Oh, that was from my friend Casey. Casey has this thing for boobs, and just because because she doesn't personally have big boobs herself, I don't know, but she does have this thing for big boobs, and so there are lots of. She and I share jokes about well-endowed women, and so that was mostly what that was. It was like this; it just happened to cross my feed, and so I thought, "Oh, Casey will certainly appreciate this." So I just posted.
Everybody loves boobs, Val
and
Haler, but
yeah, and so it's like I didn't expect to get all the responses to that particular post that I did. I'm going on, I don't know how many responses now, but like quite a few, just because I guess many people were impressed with that woman's endowments.
I saw it. I was just shocked it came from you. I figured it's from one of my male friends.
Oh. Well, if you look carefully at my feed, I put all kinds of things up.
Booptacular.
Booptacular.
All right. Joe just gave us a zero. My God, a zero man. My God, man. Those reptilians are drinking booze over here. My God, they're everywhere.
We actually wasted an entire 50 minutes of time. Ah!
Thank God you talk a lot.
Well, yeah, I just point it at me, and I'll talk about stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of compliments in the chat room.
Good.
All righty, everybody. Thanks for listening. Coming up next is Supernatural Substation, and we'll see you next Friday. I'm going to rest. I actually recorded Guns N' Roses in concert for some reason. I haven't listened to them since they're doing their new thing. I want to watch that later.
Marvin. Have a lovely
time.
We'll
see you all next Friday. Good night, everybody.